Sixth lecture. That means we're more than halfway through from my perspective. Now, I have the press negligently has brought to the world the fact that we are subsidized by big business and the wealthy of the community. I won't identify which newspaper carried that news, but I want to dispel that rumor. And in the course of doing that, appeal to you for your support in the form of memberships, or if you feel strongly about what we do, donations. We are entirely dependent upon those two sources of funds for the resource to carry on the Institute, which, as you know, was established in 1916, and so far as I know, has never had subsidy from any source. So the only way we can dispel the rumor, of course, is to continue to invite you to become members. Now, on behalf of the Institute, I welcome our second Canadian and first native-born speaker this term, Dr. Alan Rodney Dobell. As befits our podium, Dr. Dobell has a sparkling academic record as a mathematician economist. He has served as a senior public servant and now serves as the fourth president of the leading institute on public issues in Canada from the campus of the University of Victoria, the Institute for Research on Public Policy. Now, the declared role of the Institute is to promote the debate on public issues. He's a disturber of ideas. His task is to analyze ideas on economic regimens, ideas on public administration. And it's in that spirit in which he has come to our podium to speak to you tonight. And he's well qualified to do so. He has a BA in Economics and Math, 1959, from UBC. I'm glad to say a distinguished student of distinguished men, Dr. Tony Scott and Dr. Tommy Hull, an MA in UBC in Mathematics in 1961. And it was Dr. Hull that first introduced or interested Dr. Dobell in computers. And I'm going to take you back a bit and tell you that his first computer was an all-whack. It occupied two whole rooms in the 1960 engineering building. It had less speed and memory than that computer that you today carry around in the palm of your hand. I'm going to tell you what ALWAC stands for, to give you another little glimpse into our background. Axel Werner Gren, automatic computer. Now, some of you may wonder who Axel Werner Gren was, and I leave that to you. His MA work was devoted to generating millions of random numbers. The philosophical problem that he worked on was the creation of tests to determine randomness, then to turn it around and to produce random numbers. On the recommendation of his then mentors, he went to MIT. Now, traditionally, Canadians had gone to the London School of Economics to do economic graduate work. He went to MIT, as he told me earlier, feeling odd, A-W-E-D, not O-D-D, but found, I'm glad to say, and Dr. Scott and Dr. Hull will be pleased to know that he had been well prepared and quickly found his way. He took his PhD in 1965 at MIT. He luckily had married, his wife is here tonight, and I welcome her, a math graduate. Marnie taught at the Dana Hall School at Wellesley, and they thus survived. He then, after MIT, taught economics for 4 years at Harvard and received the luster that flows from that. And in 1967-68, joined with a group of Canadians, three of whom were from Vancouver, to develop an idea. They thought that they would move as a group to establish in Canada an institute for policy analysis. The proposal was only partly successful, and it was developed by Dr. John Bossens and Dr. Tom Wilson. It ran into a Trudeau proposal. The Honorable Pierre Elliott Trudeau, then the new Prime Minister, who was working on a proposal which he had delegated to Mr. Ritchie, then the head of Imperial Oil, to explore the concept of a National Institute for Social and Economic Studies. While Mr. Ritchie was working on his proposal, no academic institution would make a decision about the Bossens proposal. The result was that the University of Toronto made individual teaching contracts with most of this group who came to the University of Toronto, but they also made available a house at 150 St. George Street Each of the individuals, including our speaker, carried teaching loads and at the same time worked together to establish what is now the Institute for Policy Analysis at the University of Toronto. It was and is a unit of an academic department within the university and, of course, had students. Dr. DeBell, in the meantime, went on with his career, and in the meantime, the Ritchie proposal continued to cook. It came to be the institute that Dr. DeBell now heads, the Institute for Research on Public Policy. The first chairman was Dr. Fred Carruthers, who also has a UBC connection. In the meantime, one of his colleagues at Toronto, Dr. Hartle, went off to the Federal Public Service in Ottawa. This led to our speaker's connection with the public service, which ended with a two-faced exposure. He had 3 years as the Deputy Secretary Planning in the Department of Finance, 1973-76, and 2 years with OECD in the General Economics Branch, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. He decided that his life was in academics and returned, fortunately, home to British Columbia and accepted Dr. Petch's invitation from the University of Victoria to take over the directorship of the School of Public Administration, where he remained until he was invited to accept his present post. When he was invited to accept this post, he thought he had two disqualifications. He didn't speak French, and he wished to remain in the West. The board of directors, chaired by hard-headed men of the rank of the Honorable Robert L. Stanfield, decided that the first was not a disqualification, and to overcome the second, they moved the institute to the University of Victoria. Now, I get a fair amount of material on my speakers. I'm not going to go any further into it, but I'm going to read you a cute little note, and I won't identify the author. Dear Dick, I hope it isn't going to overwhelm you trying to extrapolate 3 or 4 fascinating minutes from this batch. Still, I thought it should be your choice. You do have to stand up there and do it. Then she clearly had a look through it and said, "Wow. A vigorous young man and only 1 year older than me." I'm very glad to invite Dr. Robert DeBell to speak to the topic, Politics and Economics in British Columbia.
Thank you very much, Dick. This introduction reminds me a little bit of Harry Rogers' remark just after being named Deputy Minister of National Revenue Taxation, when he said, this introduction outlines the life story of a man who can't hold a job. Even though I'm now in the private sector and I don't any longer enjoy the pleasures of tenured existence, I'm still hopeful that I don't encounter the wrath of an aroused citizenry the way that the Deputy Minister of National Revenue Taxation might turn out to do. I would like to emphasize, in case Dick's observations left any doubt, that on my move into the Institute for Research and Public Policy, I was not, so far as I know, I was not fired by the University of Victoria because I was unpopular with the government nearby. Mind you, the University of Victoria didn't hesitate as long as I thought they might when I suggested that they could free up their budget a little bit if they would move the off the budget and provide a house on the campus as an office for the institute. But having done that, it seems to me that they have, in fact, achieved a net gain. The house is a good location for the Institute for Research and Public Policy, at least for the Western office thereof, and we launched that undertaking yesterday afternoon with a small ceremony and a short set of observations by Robert Stanfield on the outlook for federal-provincial relations. Given the audience here this evening, I'm a little bit odd, and I rather wish that Robert Stanfield had stayed on and would talk to you about politics and economics in British Columbia and leave me to sit and observe. However, I do have to talk about politics and economics in British Columbia. A friend who was for a number of years very close to the political scene in British Columbia greeted that title with very great and evident amusement, observing that both subjects are very much discussed in British Columbia, but never at the same time and never in the same place. Since I had intended to suggest the theme that we need to look at both of these topics together, that news was rather disconcerting. And I was forced to wonder whether the idea of such an integration was really a personal little nostalgia trip. When I realized my hopes to return to Canada, as Dick has outlined, it was to join the University of Toronto with a joint appointment in economics and mathematics. But the following year, I was promoted to the position of professor of political economy. And at the time, I thought that was very quaint. But now, with the wisdom, or at least the perspective that comes with advancing years, I realized that the University of Toronto's Department of Political Economy was really so far behind the swings of academic fashion in economic science that it was way ahead. Just as we know that if I keep my wide ties for long enough, they'll take over from my narrow ones, or maybe it's the other way around. I'm not quite sure where in the cycle we stand at the moment. So it occurs to me now that I wish I could be a professor of political economy, or even better, a professor of moral philosophy once again. Unfortunately, like those of us who pitch out our narrow ties just at the wrong time, my understanding is that the University of Toronto has now done away with political economy, and it's left the economists to operate on the side in splendid scientific isolation. In any case, however that may be, I do want to suggest as one theme that we're not looking at politics and economics, but at political economy. Before I try to develop that theme, though, I'd like to suggest a couple of other personal observations as preliminaries. My interest as an academic is in applications. It's in applied analysis. And in the field of public policy, that interest creates some very perplexing dilemmas. Analysts are concerned with efficiency. They're concerned with effective solutions to problems. They're concerned with managerial rationality or with consequential rationality, with the choice of action to achieve in the most economical way desired outcomes of perceived highest utility. It's to that goal that much of the theoretical and the academic work in the field is directed. The politician, the applied political economist perhaps on the other hand, has to be more concerned with what is acceptable, what is responsive to the public will, with political rationality, with procedural rationality. And the reconciliation of these competing perspectives is an exercise in political economy, as I just mentioned, but it's more than that. It's also to recognize that this reconciliation hinges on judgments that have inescapable social and human consequences. It's not simply that economic constraints dictate political or social opportunities and possibilities, dictate the room within which we can operate, which is the way the problem is often viewed. It's also the case that the political choices determine, in many ways, the economic opportunities and the economic potential and the economic possibilities which are open to us. Those choices impact very differently on different people. They distribute the pain and the suffering and the benefits and the risks of community life differently. And they're, in that sense, fundamentally moral judgments. And the problem posed by the title that was set for me is therefore not simply a problem in political economy, but a matter of moral philosophy. So a second point that I want to emphasize is that it's not possible to escape responsibility for political choices or political judgments simply by appeal to economic constraints or the dictates of economic mechanisms. I'm going to argue later that it's also not possible to escape responsibility by arguing that the people made me do it, but that's a separate issue to which I will come. Last of my preliminary observations is to note the sense of personal privilege that I feel to be invited to address this very distinguished gathering this evening. Never as an apprehensive freshman on a very much smaller version of this campus would it have occurred to me that I might return to speak to you, an audience like you, from the same sort of platform as was trod by that awesome, and I don't mean odd, I mean awesome group of teachers who lectured to me here. And that point's not irrelevant to what I'd like to explore as a theme with you tonight. My mother, who's here tonight, came to this city from Enderby, not going to disclose anything indiscreet, but close to 60 years ago, to enter nursing training, never saw the inside of a post-secondary institution. My father, who can't be here tonight, was on his own, working in the woods up the coast north of Toba Inlet 60 years ago, never saw the inside of a post-secondary institution. Indeed, when he proposed working night shifts in order to finish high school and pursue a dream of medical school, the university at that time couldn't contemplate the arrangement. So for 60 years, they logged and they fished and they worked and they paid taxes in this province. And part of the result was that I was able to go further in school than they could ever have dreamed or expected. And when I got out here, I found that their tax dollars supported a group of extraordinarily talented, dedicated teachers who so fired me as a student, prepared me that I was able to go on to MIT, finish very well indeed in their PhD program, and move on into teaching myself. And as I reflect on it, I marvel at the richness of a university in which a randomly selected freshman with a randomly selected group of courses could spend a year with a group like Tommy Hull in mathematics and Jim Brown in physics and Barnett Savory in philosophy and Jeff Andrew, samplings of Roy Daniels and Mo Steinberg, George Woodcock in English, Tony Scott, Tadek Matuszewski in economics. The point that I want to make is that if you were to encounter a new generation, a yuppie generation, that was concerned about liberty and self-reliance and self-sufficiency and freedom to realize their own potential, their own economic opportunity, surely this tax-supported institution has to be counted as one of the major avenues for achieving precisely those objectives. And surely the investment of society's resources, mobilized through the tax system, channeled into this sort of public sector institution, has done more to create opportunities for people to pursue their own goals and realize their own ambitions than many so-called private sector wealth-creating exercises that one could name. Surely to argue in the name of individual liberty for cutting drastically the flow of tax dollars to this public sector investment in favor of higher personal disposable incomes is at least perverse. 60 years of tax payments were channeled in part and largely as an article of faith into a social investment that opened up for my generation, for my children's generation, worlds that were simply beyond the aspirations of those who earlier carved this country out of a wilderness. Is that not wealth creation? Were those tax dollars unproductively used simply because they fell within the public sector? I'm reminded of the work of the great welfare economist Pigou, writing in the 20s and 30s, who emphasized the direct relationship between satisfaction of material needs and productive efficiency as one justification for some degree of redistribution. A June 1984 review in the Review of Economic Literature observed that Pigou argued that the poverty of a significant proportion of the population, especially children, represented an untapped resource, investment in which would pay more in terms of increases in the dividend, that is GNP, than further investments in machines. The investments expected to yield the highest returns were those in school meals, health care, and industrial training. So the third theme that I'd like to emphasize with you tonight is that we need a less simplistic, a less categorical approach to the notions of wealth and productivity than much of the language that's colored recent debates about politics and economics in BC. Well, one further disclaimer, I guess, before I move on to develop that argument, I have to do a small commercial break. Some speakers are bashful about advertising their organizations, and others are discreet enough to entrust their commercial message to those who introduce them. I can't afford to be either. So I'd like to tell you where I'm coming from before sketching some flesh around these three themes, partly because the Institute for Research on Public Policy may not be as well known to you as it should be, as it deserves to be, and partly I have to say something because I am no longer the university professor whom some of you may recognize as having spoken and written on some aspects of this topic before. Also, I should be candid, the Institute for Research and Public Policy is an independent, nonprofit organization, technically a charity, always in need of money. And therefore, if you are moved this evening to make a sizable donation in support of research and public policy, let me urge you not to suppress that urge. As I mentioned, we had the happy occasion to open yesterday the new office of the Institute, which actually makes 7 across the country, the others being in Halifax, Quebec City, Montreal, Ottawa, Calgary, and one that's shared in Toronto with the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. So the Institute's a national body, but it's more particularly one dedicated to decentralization, to regional perspectives. We don't believe that it's possible to comment knowledgeably and sensitively about all public policy in Canada from Toronto or Montreal or Ottawa. As Dick has said, the IRPP was proposed in 1968, established in 1972. In contrast to some others in this field, we have no particular orientation, either for or against markets, for or against governments, or for or against the intervention of governments in markets or markets in governments. As an organization, we espouse no political persuasion, take no official positions on the policy questions that are studied. The conclusions or recommendations resulting from the research that's sponsored by the Institute are attributed solely to the researchers themselves, who are usually university scholars commissioned on particular projects. So the point of all this, the observation applies to me tonight. The opinions that I outline are personal views. They are not necessarily endorsed by the Institute, nor by any of those associated with it, and only I am to blame. Please don't blame my colleagues or my sponsors. Let me turn to the topic at hand, observing Alan Fotheringham in columns for Maclean's magazine sometimes likes to refer to British Columbia as British California. Sometimes Fotheringham's wit is so caustic that it completely chars the idea that he's attempting to develop. But in this case, I think the point is quite straightforward. The notion that British Columbia, like California, is a place from which new waves often begin. Of course, you could argue that really all the new waves begin in California and they simply splash over British Columbia on their way east. But in any case, in the Canadian context, specifically in the field of provincial economic policymaking, all provincial governments and the newly elected federal government are tracking the size, the momentum, and the direction of this British Columbia's current wave with intense interest. Only a lot of study will determine whether these political jurisdictions should be trying to ride the wave with us, or trying to build dikes against it. And I suppose that a concern for that question explains, at least in part, the invitation to me to be here tonight. And I hope for that reason that at least some of my observations will suggest at least some tangential connection with that question. But despite the simple-minded wave analogy, that question is really, it seems to me, very complex, very puzzling. It involves some very confused and confusing economic and political phenomena. The drama is still unfolding, and the information required for independent analysis is not all publicly available. All of us are limited in our understanding of these events by some very imperfect states of economic and political and sociological theory. And anybody who claims to you that the relevant scientific evidence, quote unquote, and the relevant economic theories are clear-cut and conclusive doesn't, I believe, understand either. Even with the passage of time, different observers are going to continue to read different messages from the indicators that we can actually record and track. So rather than attempt some sort of third-inning scorecard on the question of restraint, therefore, I want simply to suggest a few general considerations to keep in mind. I'd like to begin with a few ideas as to the long-term forces operating on the BC economy. I'd like to emphasize that my reading of the economic problem does not dispute the central importance of efforts to restore the competitive position of British Columbia in a world setting. In fact, my reading would emphasize that there are three layers of cost with which one has to be concerned. Increases in those costs contribute to the deterioration of that competitive position. One has to worry about direct wage costs. One has to worry about non-wage labor costs that are imposed to help finance the indirect social benefits or the social wage. and one has to worry about the cost of compliance with regulatory constraints. But I want to go on to argue that a strategy that's aimed at forcing down those costs through what is in effect direct confrontation has at least to be tested against an alternative strategy of attempting to increase productivity through cooperative action while constraining some of those sources of cost increase. So in the first place, I want to suggest that even if one accepts the problem diagnosis which seems to underlie the BC government's restraint program and agrees that action to restore competitive position can put us again on the road to renewed growth, growth at full employment with rising real incomes, there's at least one different strategy to achieve such an improved competitive position. That's a strategy of talking down expectations and talking out differences. Beyond that, it seems to me, one has to ask whether a return to traditional full employment with rising incomes can be achieved soon, or whether one has to confront the possibility of persistent economic slack of such magnitude for sufficiently long that some important change in fundamental institutions has to be contemplated. And for that purpose, too, it seems to me that it is important to seek channels of mutual cooperation without the climate of hostility and even contempt that seems to me to be encouraged by much of the rhetoric of restraint. So I come back in the end to the importance of attitudes and institutions promoting cooperative approaches to conflict resolution in situations where it's at least arguable that competitive behavior leaves everyone worse off. Well, there is not time this evening to sketch in the detail that's here the economic context and outlook in BC. Let me simply observe very quickly that economic history in BC has largely been one of commodity booms, where the price of natural resource exports in terms of imported manufactured goods rises, and commodity busts, where the relative resource prices move in the opposite direction. Recent evidence from the Economic Council of Canada in its Western Transition document published last month suggests that these boom and bust phases have diminished in intensity during the last decade. But the point remains that recent economic and political events in BC can only be understood in terms of the provincial government's fiscal position relative to the general health of the provincial economy. During the period from early 70s to 1981, BC experienced the euphoria of a major resource price boom, which is broadly based in terms of the commodities involved, and worldwide. There was a significant impression formed that BC, the BC economy, had become inflation-proof. It was largely untouched by downturns in the late 70s. From 81 to approximately 1983, and some would argue that it's still continuing, BC experienced major social disruption due to the worldwide collapse in resource prices and in general output levels, and the destruction of local asset values. It became painfully clear that far from being recession-proof, the BC economy may turn out to be extraordinarily vulnerable. Well, that economic roller coaster ride has to be understood as a starting point, it seems to me, for the logic of restraint. To understand that roller coaster ride, the economy of BC is best thought of as a small, open, resource-rich part of a larger Canadian political and economic union, which is itself part, a small part, of an increasingly integrated world economy. Now, the point of smallness has a special meaning in this kind of discussion. BC is small relative to the size of the interprovincial and international markets in which our exports, import competing goods, fight for market share. The policy implication which emerges from that observation is that international market forces determine the Canadian dollar price of BC exports and import competing goods. I won't go through this sort of material in detail, which is familiar to you, but the essential point that emerges is that world markets for tradable goods set the upper limit of revenues available. BC factors of production, labor, management, owners of capital, owners of raw natural resources, can be employed only to the extent that the total amount of payments to them doesn't exceed the production revenue available. The implication, obviously, is that if rates are too high, the quantities employed will be reduced. Some slippage in that kind of a relationship is possible only if the regional government can manipulate the world price of its tradable commodities by means of export taxes or tariffs, or if the regional government can depreciate the currency, or if it could follow an independent interest rate policy. And since BC doesn't have sufficient economic clout in world markets to manipulate the price of its tradable goods and services, and since devaluation and separate interest rate policy aren't possible, since we use the same currency as the rest of the country and we exist in a world of highly mobile capital, all of this limits the economic policy options available to a regional government with respect to tradable goods. With respect to the non-tradable sector, provincial authorities retain a large, important, and visible policy role to play. That non-tradable sector is mainly, although not exclusively, composed of service industries such as transportation, communication, storage, wholesale and retail trade, finance, insurance, and real estate, business and personal service, public administration, and defense. They aren't a trivial part. They are not a trivial part of the BC economy. Census data since 1941 confirms that BC has a large and rapidly expanding service sector. In fact, in all census years up to and including 81, the percentage of the labor force employed in the service sector in BC has always been in excess of the Canadian average, higher than any of the provinces west of Quebec. In British Columbia in 1981, Statistics Canada data suggests that 7 out of 10 workers are employed in the service sector. Nearly 5 out of those 7 service sector employees are in wholesale and retail trade or selling business and personal services. By contrast, perhaps surprisingly, resource industries per se accounted directly for only 15% of provincial GDP in 1981, only 12% of employment. Indirectly, of course, a great deal of manufacturing and service activity is linked inextricably to those resource sectors. But my point is, you have to think of British Columbia as more than a resource-based economy. It has a large and growing non-traded service sector. For that sector, I would argue that British Columbians are to a much greater extent masters of their own economic fate. We do not have the same problem of fixed exchange rates and inability to influence world resource prices when we come to look at the instruments of provincial economic control. At home, the provincial government's fiscal and political stance in the economy can have a tremendous direct impact on 7 out of those 10 jobs. Policies which force the cutback or the closure of publicly financed institutions that are attempting to facilitate the labor adjustment from a resource-based to an information and service-based economy, or which instill so much uncertainty in the system that expectations of hard times become in effect self-fulfilling, those sorts of actions can be squared with these facts only with a great deal of difficulty, it seems to me. A second structural economic reality that has to be faced in this province is that a relatively large proportion of what is produced in BC is also consumed here. Partly this is a reflection of the fact, which I've already mentioned, that BC has a large non-traded service sector, but more importantly, producers based in BC do not export very much to the other Canadian provinces. There's a good reason for that. Slightly east of here, one finds some big hills to go over. But the fact is that we have a low level of exports from British Columbia to the rest of Canada. And it's low enough, in fact, that even when you take into account our higher level of exports to other countries, total provincial exports, international and provincial, are the lowest of any of the provinces west of Quebec. The policy implication of that observation is that economic and political events which destroy consumer confidence and the ability of the provincial economy to generate income and wealth to take up their own production may have a somewhat larger impact in BC than in other provinces. Domestic in-province consumers have to be relied on to buy relatively more of the goods and services that are produced here. Well, again, suggest that to a significant degree, we are masters of our own economic fate. Homegrown economic and political developments, to the extent that they destroy consumer confidence or impede adjustment to a service information-based economy, have the potential to reduce the levels of income and wealth produced in this province. And the conclusion is that all important economic variables aren't determined outside of British Columbia's borders. A third structural economic issue, which has a bearing on the analysis of economic and political events, concerns the issue of wage rates in this province. It's been argued by a number of observers that much of the natural resource revenue that should have been collected by the provincial government as the owners of the resource through things like stumpage fees or profit taxes have instead been captured by largely organized workers in terms of excessively high wage rates in the primary producing sectors. The argument is that these high wage rates become the standard to which workers in the non-resource industries aspire. They set the tone in the non-tradable goods sectors, and over time, a wage structure in excess of the competitively determined level spills out into the whole BC economy. That's the so-called Dutch disease, one which troubled analysts and economic policy makers in a lot of countries. The argument is that labor income levels that are based on wages set by that kind of pattern of development produce a comfortable but a very vulnerable, tenuous, dangerous existence. The obvious problem is that ultimately one reaps a harvest of chronic unemployment and associated social costs. Of course, labor costs are far from the only element of cost affecting competitive position. Real interest costs are at unprecedentedly high levels. Many analysts explain that in terms of a shortage of real capital, which will not go away within the next decade or two. And the direct wage is itself far from the only element of labor costs that matters. One of the arguments is that growing non-wage labor costs, things like payroll taxes to finance universal social security schemes, figure in the decision to hire labor, even though they aren't counted as personal disposable income, by the laborer. And if you like, the asymmetry between the low value that's placed by the recipient on this social wage and the high value that's placed on the reduction in personal disposable income required to finance it through taxes is a major explanation for the current problems. Observe in passing that the growing pursuit of social goals through regulation generates increasing compliance costs for industry. And one can, looking at these issues, develop a story of what is happening in the economy which foresees persistent inflationary problems in the fact that we do have a continuing individual desire for rising material standards of living. Part of the present backlash against big government stems from the fact of this desire for personal, private, direct command over resources in preference to generalized social benefits or social wages, which always seem to accrue to somebody else. But the strategy in response to that problem, I would argue, can't be to question the legitimacy of the general social goals which are represented in that social wage to the point of insisting on the preeminence of market signals or market forces in the management of the developed economies. The need is to develop institutions which somehow can communicate effectively the scope for bargaining, which can transmit to individuals the reality as to what is and what is not feasible in the way of income claims. Now, I want to talk a little bit about how that can be accomplished. I want also to observe that we have to keep in the back of our mind the notion that maybe as resource costs increase, and more particularly as the rising claims of the growing world outside Canada and outside the OECD countries develop, has to be faced that material standards of living in the OECD countries can't increase as quickly as they have in the past. In other words, we may have to go back to the beginning and adjust our starting point for this discussion. That aspiration to continued rates of increase, continued positive growth in income standards, may not be realizable. You may even want to ask whether it's a sensible goal for an economy which has become as rich as the North American economy. Well, let me not belabor this discussion too long. There is, in light of the problem that I sketched, an argument that says policy can offer a solution only through a process of wage deflation that's achieved by challenging directly the institutions and the bargaining processes that are thought to be responsible for high wage rates. Only by taking decisive action directed specifically against wage rates, it's argued, can the provincial economy be put on new economic footings capable of supporting a rebuilt economy. I'm concerned that that is a solution that is adopted too quickly, and that there is an alternative which offers the possibility of at least progress towards a soft landing for the economy, and that's to use the period of high wages to realign the skill base of the workforce towards that which is appropriate to a more dynamic tertiary sector. Let me develop that argument slightly. Let me skip a long story about the Economic Council's document, which confronts really two theories of growth in British Columbia. One theory, the so-called growth and retrenchment school, which says our salvation will come in a return to a prosperous resource sector. And since we have, in the immediate and possibly in the longer term outlook, not much opportunity for rising prices for our resources in world markets, then the only way in which we can maintain per capita income levels with a resource-based economy, which is pushing its way up the supply curve, is for population to leave. Growth and retrenchment involves, in some sense, net out-migration as the ultimate result. Since the longer-term outlook for the resource sectors isn't, in fact, looking very optimistic, that may be a possibility one has to take seriously. The second approach, which is labeled resource growth and evolution by the Economic Council, suggests, as the title makes clear, that you start, indeed, with regional income and wealth streams based on exploiting the resource sectors, but prosperity is sustained by developing other export commodities and other import replacement sectors. The evolution is possible, in fact, because of population in migration, with the hope that this kind of growth will capture so-called agglomeration economies, create a process of self-sustaining growth in the evolution phase of development, one which will result in the kind of transition to service-based economy that I've alluded to previously. Let me move on quickly to skip the discussion of alternative views of the public sector. And let me summarize this portion of the discussion by suggesting that it's hard to believe of the British Columbia economy that one can cut real wages and the social wage and the social goals that are associated with compliance with regulation enough to restore BC's competitive position in the traditional industries and still be acceptable public policy. The only solution, it seems to me, is not to pursue that goal, which seems self-defeating, but is to take the action which will increase productivity in traditional lines of endeavor and in the new high-tech activities, high-tech but low employment, very probably, to increase productivity in these areas enough to support public investment in infrastructure, in research, in training, in adjustment assistance, and the like, and to sustain a tax base which will employ a growing body of workers in essential human and community services. In other words, one is arguing that increasing productivity is a way of restoring competitive position, but obviously it carries with it the connotation of lower employment, not higher. And so improving competitive position through increasing productivity may restore levels of output. It is not going to solve the unemployment problem. On the other hand, it is not possible to believe that you can solve the unemployment problem by cutting wages to the extent that would be necessary. So the argument is, let us use the dynamics of the resource sectors, not with the expectation that that's going to be where our employment problem is solved, but with the expectation that a dynamic resource sector can generate the surplus, which will in fact make possible the transition of the BC economy to a structure in which service sector exports and service sector domestic sales are considerably greater employers than they are now, and in fact, to the point where a tax base will be in place to permit restoration of growth in the traditional sources of high employment growth in this province, which have been in education and health care and social services. Those are the service areas in which employment growth has been greatest. They don't happen to be the traditional high technology activities, but they do happen to respond, it seems to me, to what one could predict will be needs in the economy in the future. Well, to accomplish any of that transition requires commitment and cooperation, and that in turn, it seems to me, implies some ground rules for political conduct. And I've talked about that, if you'll forgive a commercial message, I've talked about that in an article in the magazine Policy Options, published by the Institute for Research in Public Policy a couple of months ago. And I don't want to try and repeat that discussion for you now. First of all, because there isn't time in any case. Well, I argued that the ground rules which should govern the exercise of a process of restraint must recognize some continuity in social events, in political life. I want to expand a little on that discussion. It isn't really good enough. The test of what's acceptable to the public is important, but it's decisive only in conjunction with some concept of personal responsibility, it seems to me as well. The government which brought in the incarceration of Japanese Canadians 40 years ago would very possibly have been reelected at the time with even more seats, either at the local level or at the federal level. And yet we don't now consider that acceptable public policy. And I think that, although I'm not suggesting any parallel to the restraint program at all, I am suggesting that that illustration points out the necessity for there to be ground rules in political life beyond the question, what is the immediate will of the public as it would be tested by this question, how many seats would we get in another election, or what do the current polls show? I really suggested this evening as well that appeal to anonymous market mechanisms won't wash. The market made me do it is no better than the people made me do it as an explanation of collective responsibility for action, which treats people or some groups of people as symbols, really, with no human significance. The market, even an international market which is bearing on a small open economy, leaves us lots of scope for judgment as to how we want to respond as a community to adverse swings in a changing world environment. Now, even if the alternative of improving competitive position in the fashion I've suggested by increasing productivity through consultation, consensus, were resoundingly successful, we still have to face the problem that the world has changed against us, the outside world, the big international world in which this small economy operates, and the possibility of sustained high unemployment, persistent economic slack, has to be confronted. And one problem that seems to me that is particularly worrisome, if we are in fact facing several years of high unemployment, is that we're not as yet paying the full ultimate price for the last recession. The strength of the safety net thus far has been remarkable, but it was not, in fact, designed for persistent economic slack. It wasn't designed for the dislocation that's likely to accompany the structural change, structural adjustment, of the degree that we might have to contemplate if we were to follow the route that I was suggesting. In particular, sustained high levels of youth unemployment, growing pools of dislocated workers in the 55 to 64-year-old bracket, or even in the 45 to 54-year-old bracket, unable to find new jobs at the end of their working life, and in fact, large numbers of less skilled workers that are displaced from traditional manual jobs, unable to penetrate the more demanding sunrise, high-tech, dynamic service sector activities. Those aren't problems with which the existing safety net is comfortable. They're not problems which existing safety nets were designed to handle. Those safety nets, those social security provisions, were designed largely, on the one hand, to bridge temporary interruptions in employment income, on the other hand, to provide a basic income to a small group, handicapped, single parents with young children, who weren't expected, are not expected, to participate fully in paid employment. These safety nets don't address the problem of sustained dependency which emerged when participation in employment fails to provide a sufficiently broadly based vehicle for the distribution of income. If you're using work as the instrument for distribution of income, and there isn't enough work to go around, there's a significant institutional problem to be faced. There are a lot of issues there. One is the measurement problem. Behind it, the sort of deeper conceptual problem, which I think we have to look at as part of political economy in BC. Our statistical system, our national accounts, weren't designed to capture non-market activities, some of which, increasing amount of which, is made possible by transfer income. Activities that are undertaken on the fringes of the economy, for example, have always posed a problem. As women move into the labor force, into the paid labor force, many activities, prepared foods, food away from home, prepared meals, that were previously unrecorded because they were part of production within the household, are supplied through markets and recorded as increases in GNP. As high wages encourage mechanisms to throw services back onto the customer, self-service gas stations, for example, or automatic teller machines for banking, recorded gross national product diminishes. But the more basic question is that the vast and the allegedly growing scope of the informal self-service economy means that there's a broad range of productive activity that's carried on but not recorded as part of the formal economy, not related to the distribution of purchasing power. So I want to argue that we've not yet come to grips with the consequences when paid work is scarce enough that earnings through employment can no longer be taken as the community-wide vehicle for income distribution. There's another aspect somewhat related. We talk in this discussion of restraint and of politics and economics in BC as if there are really two organizational forms at war, the private corporation and the public bureaucracy, and a big gulf between them. But increasingly, it seems to me, one has to recognize that the evidence suggests that hierarchical and bureaucratic structures in either private or public enterprise are very similar to each other, and they are very different from the small owner-operated enterprises that are operating on the fringe of the formal monetary economy, and very different from the small self-service activities that are carried on just over the border in the informal economy. And it's that residual economy into which our unemployment problems are spilling, and it's the conditions in that residual economy, and the question whether there are ways in which the activities in that informal economy can be made visible, recognized as worthwhile, it seems to me crucial in some of the present discussion of institutional change. Well, some of that concern is what lies behind my claim that there's a need to examine social and economic policy together. I would argue that the convenient fiction of economic theory that you can first of all pursue the goal of a truly efficient allocation of resources and then afterwards, at your leisure, determine the desirable and equitable distribution of the product has never been accepted by the practicing politician. It's never been accepted in practice in the community, in fact. And we ought to abandon it as a starting point for our rhetoric. In the first place, the desired redistribution often doesn't occur. It's difficult to achieve globally, and and traditionally one seeks it program by program. But more important than that, social policy is intimately and legitimately connected with the nature of the workplace itself. And it's not possible to separate the pursuit of social goals in the workplace from the pursuit of an efficient allocation of resources. I listened to the McDonald Commission debates, the public debates this spring, and was impressed how much of the problem that people were trying to address in this discussion of self-reliance and where we go in social policy, how much of the problem is connected to this changing boundary between the claims of work and the claims of the rest of one's life. It was a problem, it seemed to me, that was dramatized by two groups of people who argued for a different approach to economic problems. One were the women's groups, and one were the native groups. As women increasingly entered the labor force, the paid labor force, the formal workplace, at all ages, there are a lot of compromises necessary with the demands of the workplace. Maternity leave, and in fact gives rise to a discussion of paternity leave. There has to be provision to meet the unexpected needs of sick kids. Generally some reduced willingness to put the demands of the job ahead of the claims of personal or family or social responsibility. The old tradition which divided the community into males for whom the priority was the job and others out of the workforce who looked after the rest of the personal and family community needs is one which doesn't stand up in the face of this pressure for women to enter the paid labor force in a way which can accommodate the conflicting claims on their time. Almost exactly the same argument was being made by some of the native groups talking about the need for self-government and independent enterprise on terms that are consistent with their own values and their own cultural tradition. The argument, I think, made perfect sense. The point is that those developments aren't violation of some immutable natural law which describes the priority, the uncompromising priority to be attached to production. Changes in those institutions aren't attempts to defy facts of life or laws of nature or even immutable laws of economics, if there are any. What they require is some shifting of the boundaries, some altering of the balance in what we classify as economic, social, public, or private. And those boundaries are at our disposal. And the present balance is very recent vintage. The kind of separation and delegation of production decisions into watertight compartments in our lives, the delegation to a particular legal fiction organized to enable the conduct of business without the involvement of personal assets, the limited liability company, is a recent development. And if you think in terms of Herman Kahn's time frame, Herman Kahn's book, The Next 200 Years, if you go back 200 years, you're back to the beginning of the corporation. If you go forward 200 years, you might ask whether in the smaller, more dispersed, and more diffuse organizational structures that we have, the organizational form is going to be the one that dominates the 200 years after that. I have to finish here, so let me simply observe in passing that in thinking about these problems, the way we organize production, and the way in which social claims impinge on activity within the formal workplace, we have to recognize that a laborer who invests in an enterprise by locating near it, by learning the skills, by learning the way things are done in this organization, by learning its networks and its people, has in fact made an investment, a considerable investment, in that operation. It's human capital, not physical capital. But there is, in any organization, a requirement for considerable knowledge that comes only with time. That laborer is an investor in that enterprise, in many ways much more committed to the enterprise, with much more at stake than the portfolio investor. And the labor contract that's involved is not, in what one would call an excellent company, is not a day-to-day contract for a flow of services, but it's a longer-term contract. And if you look then at the kinds of adjustment processes which have to be contemplated in this economy, it seems to me that it becomes plausible to recognize the social costs of uprooting a community, requiring people to change jobs, change location, change organizations, as investment costs that have to be paid in just the same way as one would treat the problems of physical capital. Well, let me, recognizing that we've now introduced a large number of separate observations into this jigsaw puzzle, let me try to summarize very quickly. I'd like to suggest that in thinking about BC, we have to think about BC in Canada, we have to think about Canada in the world. Current thinking about what is happening in the world economy seems to me to be split. It seems fragmented, it's very uncertain. There are two general streams of thought, it seems to me. The first suggests that current events show that the mechanisms of market adjustment are responding well to changing circumstances. They're leading to a globally optimal allocation of resources in which the U.S. economy is emerging as a dominant influence, re-emerging as a major stabilizing influence in the world economy, a healthier economy, a more attractive place to invest. It's an economy which is borrowing at an incredible rate at the moment. Under the influence of that new U.S. economy, the encroachment of barriers to trade and adjustment are being rolled back in a way that leads to recovery for the rest of the world. Down the road, one supposes a reasonably orderly transition to a nice, prosperous post-industrial society. That's one reading. Contrary view suggests that the current miraculous U.S. recovery, which is being cited as a model, stems largely from its unique, no other economy in the world, unique power to spread the cost of its own domestic policies over the rest of the world. What's undeniably a rational policy for the United States can hardly be viewed as a globally optimal allocation of resources in a situation in which the richest economy in the world is emerging as a spendthrift borrower, massive capital importer, shortly to be a net debtor. The improved appeal of the U.S. economy as a destination for investment and capital from around the world, in this view, is attributed in large part to nervousness, to significant changes in the quality of property rights, and the view is sometimes associated with the longer-run pessimism that sees emerging pressures, misallocation of increasingly scarce resources as the major problem for the future. The problem, of course, is, as always in economics, the sword has two edges and the scissors have two blades, and it's good to have an engine of expansion in the world economy. It's good to have a spendthrift borrower. If you want to stimulate demand and expenditure, having somebody live beyond their means is precisely what you need. Of course, there is a question as to how long you can do that, but what one needs to encourage demand in the short run is living beyond one's means, whether the expenditures are for consumption purposes or for investment purposes. And if capital from other countries is willing to flow to the U.S. to finance spenders there, so much the better for recovery in the world economy, so much better for exporters selling to the U.S. But as an allocation of scarce world resources, a big U.S. trade deficit, U.S. consumption of the resources and production in the rest of the world, financed by purchasing power drawn in from all of the other developed and developing countries, made possible by debt repayments that are forced through reduced imports onto the poorest countries, it's got to look a little bit perverse. So the question, the present emphasis on U.S.-led recovery in the world is in some sense a measure of how far thinking is still dominated, despite all the talk about supply-side economics, dominated by demand-side considerations. When we confront the question whether this is really the way in which the world should evolve, have to ask ourselves whether it's necessary to accept that the richest economy in the world has one of the lowest saving rates, consumes increasing amounts of the world's resources to the point of moving from the role of a large creditor to a large debtor. Is it necessary to assume that continuous accumulation, driven by the goal of continuous growth of real incomes, an increase in material living standards, can remain the driving force of that economy no matter how rich it gets? So the question is, if we look at the longer-term outlook for BC as part of this world economy, Can we see that prospect as even sustainable as the population in the rest of the world expands and becomes aware of its own relative position? Well, I asked that question as a setting for the BC economy. What can we conclude as an outlook for BC itself? I've argued that one way or the other, one has to expect this province to move toward an increasing role for tertiary and quaternary activities, service sectors and service activities, using the resource sectors in some sense as the leverage whereby research and development activities, exports of services can provide the vehicle for domestic activity in BC to find markets outside the country. Service sectors and service activities will play growing roles in the way BC and British Columbians make their way in the world. Arrangements governing trade and services, therefore, are going to be critical to BC, and negotiations on that score are going to be important, should be carefully monitored. And if it's true that the service sector is going to play that kind of a key role, then the deployment and utilization of human capital is central. If you examine, it's my impression, the literature on organizations that are excellent, display excellence in the mobilization and deployment of human capital, the values that are emphasized are not the values of the marketplace. If you look at The Art of Japanese Management, for example, or In Search of Excellence, what they talk of is consensus and sustained commitment and pride and motivation. If we're going to go into a discussion of means to increase productivity and moderate the growth of production costs, it seems to me we have to go into those discussions without the albatross of all these doctrinal categories that hang around our necks. We aren't split into two competing camps, private sector and public, or wealth creating and wealth redistributing. We're not simply producers in one group and consumers in another. We might elect, for some purposes, more formal or hierarchical or bureaucratic structures in the public sector, accountable to a large group of voters, or we might elect, for other purposes, structures with continuing accountability to a small group of shareholders, or we may elect small organizational forms participating in formal exchange in a cash economy or small clusters operating in an informal self-service economy. But that choice is ours, and it's not a matter of right versus wrong. So I'm arguing that partly the reaction against the public sector, it seems to me, is a state of mind. Since it isn't any longer socially acceptable in public to treat visible minorities as whipping boys, it's useful to have, sometimes people with fundamentalist leanings find it convenient to have, some other identifiable class in the community to serve as objects of scorn and maybe the occasion for some very comfortable feeling of superiority. That may not be a real problem, but like all prejudices, it leads to errors, and sometimes errors of judgment with respect to the role of the public sector. I will argue that there are lots of organizational forms other than arm's length exchange on organized markets for dealing with economic and social problems. But I'm not going to go into that argument in detail at this stage. So what I've tried to do is situate these remarks as a link from academic and theoretical work to the very concrete decisions that we have to take collectively in the face of economic change. I've tried to sketch the present economic setting, a bit of the evolution that seems to me to have brought us here. And in the puzzling outlook, the very, very difficult to read outlook which attends that economic setting, and in the dilemma which is where we go from here, I see only one clear certainty, and that is that we as a community are condemned to work together in that long run, however much our interests may appear to conflict in the short run, and whatever deals are going to be imposed now through the exercise of power during this swing of the pendulum, we're going to have to meet around other tables in other years during other phases of the cycle and cut other deals. And the one thing that's sure is that we have shared stakes in the survival of that economic and social system. For the purpose of working together, I find very appealing the general lines of argument that are suggested by Norman Spector, for example, in a speech to Montreal, which which in Montreal, the Institute of Public Administration of Canada, which in fact, my last commercial plug, this will appear shortly in Policy Options magazine, which you will now recognize to be published by the Institute for Research in Public Policy, in which Spector suggests the importance of institutions for conflict resolution. I recommend to you a book by a political scientist called Axelrod, called The Evolution of Cooperation, which addresses the question, how can cooperation emerge in situations of short-run conflict? By what means could cooperation be encouraged even where conflicting interests dominate? Interestingly enough, Axelrod's book suggests that the dominating principle there might be some notion of reciprocity as the vehicle by which one forces non-competing, non-cooperative, non-communicating players to evolve toward a cooperative solution, a cooperative policy. I've suggested in this regard in other places that I like the consultative approach that was adopted by Prime Minister Bob Hawke of Australia in that respect. I argued earlier, in effect, that an important principle, both within an organization and across the economy, is that a major part of the economic gains from greater productivity that can be achieved by changing work rules, redeploying labor, major part of the gains have to be reinvested in the career prospects of those who are displaced and in support of those who are adversely affected. I believe that the BC government and the BCGEU, for example, were on the right track in their ill-fated joint consultative committee on productivity that was established at the behest of the union in 1982, destroyed in the aftermath of the 1983 election. It seems to me that something like that must be recreated if sustained economic progress is going to be possible. I'd advocate more generally that Mr. Mulroney should adopt an approach similar to Mr. Hawke's, an approach focused on the notion of consultation with all the groups affected in the economy, but with one important difference. Because I think that our short-term crisis is going to arise from the fact that this basic safety net isn't designed for persistent economic slack, I think the consultative process is going to have to be more broadly scoped. And what I would suggest is a consultative process that starts with a well-prepared summit meeting, a socioeconomic summit meeting, maybe a year from now, which is still early enough in the life of a new administration to permit action. The important feature of that kind of a summit meeting is that it wouldn't be confined to the concerns of the formal sectors and the large organizations in the economy. It would have to involve some of those from the informal economy, the small organizations, the non-government organizations, voluntary agencies, and similar groups representing social policy as well as economic policy concerns as part of this integrated political economy. I've suggested in passing that there is no conflict necessary between notions of efficiency and equity in an economy which has to adjust, has to adapt, has to permit the mobility of labor as well as other resources. A well-designed safety net, a well-designed social security program is part of the machinery that's necessary to permit, facilitate, and even to make possible that adjustment. I should finish by saying that this isn't an incantation of consultation with the thought that the process is going to have magical healing powers. One doesn't expect that conflict is going to disappear merely because one invokes magic words like consultation and coordination. But conflict can be resolved, and with reasonable goodwill, the resolution can be made to stick, which is really the important problem that is faced in this concern with so-called distributional coalitions. Problem is not that the conflict can't be resolved. Problem is that coalitions can block the resolution even after agreement has appeared to be reached. Well, suggestions like come let us reason together or the even more prosaic, let us calculate, aren't invocations to dissolve conflict. They're simply invitations to a process that might tell us better what is the room for discourse, what are the relevant facts of life, what's the feasible range of exchange. We still have to choose a response, and in choosing, we define ourselves and what we stand for. There's another well-known saying that was much repeated in the early 60s, attributed to Dante, observation that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in time of moral crisis, preserve their neutrality. Political institutions are vehicles for collective choice, just as our economic institutions. Individuals and corporations have to bear moral responsibility, just as officials in public agencies and politicians and all of us as individuals in our everyday life must. And what I've argued this evening, I guess, is that in the politics and the economics of British Columbia or in Canada, the people made me do it, or the market made me do it, is not a good enough accounting. Thank you very much.